Okay, so this talk is on Lenin's theory of national liberation, and for that reason it's going to be more or less restricted to Lenin's time. So I'll use examples from Lenin's times, and I'm going to try and situate his theory in the context of the debates that existed at that point in the socialist movement. But despite this, my key argument is that all of Lenin's basic points on national liberation apply today. And so I'm going to try and make a couple of key points. The first is that Lenin was by far the most democratic thinker in the socialist movement at the time. He pioneered the only socialist theory that was genuinely sensitive to the aspirations of oppressed populations. In doing so, he avoided the pitfall of becoming a nationalist, and he connected support for national liberation with socialism's goal of internationalism. And his theories were confirmed in the practice of the Russian Revolution. And this was the single greatest liberating event for tens of oppressed populations. And so his theory and its concrete application are the starting point for our understanding of national liberation today. In that regard, he made a political breakthrough for Marxism. So to begin with Marx and Engels, and they obviously were working in the 19th century, and it was a crazy century, full of revolutions, modernisation, oppression, war, and all those kinds of things. And so in that context, Marx and Engels began to work out a theory of national liberation. Now, their starting point was internationalism, workers of the world unite, you know, that slogan associated with the Communist Manifesto and the First International. And they saw nations correctly as a product of capitalism and a way in which workers are divided by capitalism. But at the same time, their world was fundamentally different from ours in that capitalism hadn't triumphed in large sections of the planet. In Europe in particular, there was the Austro-Hungarian and Russian empires, which, while they had capitalist sectors of the economy, they had also backwards semi-feudal sectors and quite backwards semi-feudal political structures. And so Marx and Engels supported bourgeois or capitalist revolutions against these kinds of these systems and these regimes. And that's not because they were blind to capitalism's injustices, but because they believed that only capitalism could create enough material wealth to liberate humanity. And so victory over these reactionary and semi-feudal empires often involved national liberation struggles. This was the case with the unification of the Italian peninsula. Italian nationalists in 1830, 1848, and again in the 1860s, fought the papacy, they fought the Habsburgs, the Austrian monarchy, and Marx and Engels supported their struggle. And similarly, Marx and Engels advocated national liberation and even revolutionary wars of national liberation for Poland, a nation dominated by Russian absolutism. On the other hand, Russia and Austria were able to manipulate certain national movements and nationalisms for their own ends. And this was particularly true of the South Slav people, including Czechs, Croats and Serbs. And so during the revolutions of 1848, these people were mobilised to crush those revolutions. And so Marx and Engels opposed those national liberation struggles because they were objectively setting back the goal of European liberation. And so a key part of the Marxist approach to national liberation is already set out here. National liberation is not an end point in itself, but a means to the end point of human liberation. But there's much more to the question than that. A renewal of the Irish struggle for independence in the 1860s forced Marx and Engels to extend their views, and they supported an Irish overthrow of British rule. And they argued, the English working class can never do anything decisive here in England until it separates its policy with regard to Ireland in the most definite way from the policy of the ruling classes, until not only it makes common cause with the Irish, but actually takes the initiative in dissolving the Union, that's the term describing Ireland's domination by England, and replacing it by a federal relationship. And that's an important passage, and there's a couple of others like it, because in it, Marx identifies the interests of the proletariat in the oppressor nation with the interests of the working class in the oppressed nation. But Marx and Engels never developed a comprehensive theory about this. So all you can really find in their works are comments on particular cases, and you can start to develop a theory out of that, which is what Lenin did. So now we come to 1903 and the famous Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party. And this conference voted on a program that included the right to self-determination in its program. And it included two key points. Point eight was the right of populations to receive education in their native language, to be ensured provision of schools needed for this purpose, at the expense of the state and organs of self-government, the right of every citizen to express himself at meetings in his own language, use of native language on an equal basis with the state language in all local public and state institutions, and point nine, the right of self-determination for all nations included within the bounds of the state. This was important in Russia because it was known at the time as the prison house of nations. It was run by a dynasty which was based on a minority population of great Russians. The dynasty dominated tens of other peoples. And because of this, Lenin and the other participants in the 1903 Congress saw the right of nations to self-determination as an essentially democratic demand against Tsarism. And his basic argument, and this was consistent throughout his career, is that the working class had to stand for the most complete democracy. So he wrote, "Victorious socialism must achieve complete democracy and consequently not only bring about the complete equality of nations, but also give effect to the right of oppressed nations to self-determination, i.e. the right to free political succession." And so in this, his starting point was basically the same as Marx's starting point had been 50-odd years before. But during the debate in 1903 and in the years afterwards, Lenin had to add a number of key points to his support for the right of nations to self-determination. The first is that the right of nations to self-determination is hollow if it doesn't extend to the right to succession. This means socialists, if they're genuine in their support for self-determination, need to defend the right to secede and the right to agitate for succession. And Lenin added that socialists should be unconditionally hostile to the use of force in any form by the dominant nation or the nation which constitutes the majority of the population in respect to a nation that wishes to secede politically. Now, this commitment can seem, at face value, at odds with socialism's internationalist goal. Socialists, after all, argue that that nations should not exist, that national borders should be dissolved, and that states in themselves shouldn't exist. That's the goal of socialism. Yet Lenin argued that this could only occur on a voluntary and democratic basis. Coercion of small nations by larger ones under the pretext of internationalism, and that has taken place, is a cruel fraud. Rather, Lenin argued that the right to unify necessarily implies its opposite, the right to secede. And that's a key point. Both Marx and Lenin had a dialectical approach to internationalism. They saw true internationalism is only possible if oppressed and subjugated nations genuinely have the right to determine their own destiny. But this raises another question. That question is, if everyone's got the right to self-determination, which nations should exercise the right to self-determination? In some ways, it's similar to divorce. Lenin advocated the right to divorce, but didn't say that everyone should get divorced. And so Lenin argued that each case should be assessed concretely. The key principle underlying Lenin's judgment of each case was what will advance the cause of revolution. And this means asking a number of questions and making an assessment based on all of the information. And to be clear, no one of these questions is decisive in determining an answer. Rather, you've got to look at the specific case, the specific national liberation struggle in question, and try and view it in the context of the overall political situation and all of those other kinds of things in terms of the balance of imperial power. So the first question to ask that begins to be a guide, does national oppression exist? The bourgeoisie or nationalists in any given nation often claim that their nation is oppressed or the victim of other nations' machinations in order to build national sentiment. But the key for Marxists is whether or not this is grounded in some reality. And if it is, Marxists have to find a way to respond to that reality. The second question is whether or not a national movement exists. For example, Jews in Russia were enormously oppressed on an ethno-religious basis. They were legally inferior to non-Jews, and they suffered regular state-sanctioned violence in the form of pogroms. Yet, the Jewish nationalist movement, the Zionist movement, was an irrelevant reactionary minority who openly looked to the support of imperialist nations to establish a Jewish state. The overwhelming majority of Jews, working class and otherwise, did not support this form of Jewish nationalism, and on the contrary, looked to the workers' movement for their own liberation. So in this context, to support Jewish secession would be insanity. It would have been to make an enormous mistake. And in practice, that would have been to the benefit of imperialism and reaction. Another example is the situation of blacks in the United States. There's never been a viable movement for secession. Rather, the struggle has focused on combating racism and demanding civil rights. So where no national movements exist demanding succession, or where they're tiny minorities that look to imperialism or whatever, socialists should not invent national movements. And that relates to another question. Is there a widespread desire amongst the population of the nation in question for secession? If so, and if secession doesn't have any necessarily reactionary consequences, then socialists should still support secession as a step towards creating a deeper internationalism between the working classes in the two nations in question. This leads to another question, though, and I already implied this question before. historically, imperialism has been able to manipulate some nationalist movements into support of its own interests. Often the bourgeoisie of an oppressed nation is happy to sell its movement to whatever imperialist country isn't dominating it in order to set up their own state. And so if a national liberation movement is going to be of objective benefit to imperialism, socialists have to oppose it, because we don't put the interests of one oppressed nation above the interests of the world and the working class of the world in combating imperialism. For example, after the Russian Revolution, imperialist and Tsarist forces, who'd never given a damn about national liberation before in their lives, suddenly championed self-determination for the sections of Russia that they happened to control. And that was a blatant cover for attacking the workers' revolution. So socialists need to ask of any national movement, is its success in the interests of the working class? And this relates to a more general point. National movements are almost always led by the bourgeoisie of the dominated country or an aspiring bourgeoisie. Lenin did not support these bourgeois elements. Rather, he supported the democratic content of national liberation movements. His goal was not to relate to the ruling class of an oppressed nation, far from it, but to relate to the legitimate grievances of the lower classes in the oppressed nation and to support their struggle against a common enemy. And in the case of Russia, that was Tsarism. So if a national liberation movement was progressive, if it contributed towards the victory over capitalism and over absolutism, Lenin supported it. And as a revolutionary socialist, Lenin subordinated national liberation to the overall goal of the workers' movement. Insofar as national liberation movements were progressive, Lenin argued that socialists should unconditionally support them, despite the fact that they're led by the bourgeoisie. And this is important. Lenin adamantly supported national liberation movements up to and including the point at which they set up independent capitalist states. Not because he supported capitalism or any capitalist classes, but because only by winning independence and removing the domination of a foreign power, and therefore securing the domination by their own ruling classes, could the working classes in the oppressed nations begin to clearly see their own class interests and therefore learn the need for complete anti-capitalist revolution. And so explaining this point, Lenin wrote, "Insofar as the bourgeoisie of the oppressed nation fights its oppressor, we are always, in every case, and more strongly than anyone else, in favour, for we are the staunchest and most consistent enemies of oppression. But insofar as the bourgeoisie of the oppressed nation stands for its own bourgeois nationalism, we stand against. That is why the proletariat confines itself, so to speak, to the negative demand for recognition of the right to self-determination without giving guarantees to any nation, and without undertaking to give anything at the expense of another nation." National liberation movements, Lenin argued, had an enormous democratic and revolutionary potential in the Russian Empire because of its multinational makeup that I mentioned before. And so he explained this later on by writing, "Russia is a state with a single national centre, Great Russia. The Great Russians occupy a vast, unbroken stretch of territory and number about 70 million. The specific features of this national state are, first, that subject peoples, which on the whole comprise the majority of the entire population, 57%, inhabit the border regions. Secondly, the oppression of these subject people is much stronger here than in neighbouring states, and not even in the European states alone. Thirdly, in a number of cases, the oppressed nationalities inhabiting the border regions have compatriots across the border who enjoy greater national independence." And he mentions a number of people that fit into that category. "Fourthly, the development of capitalism and the general level of culture are often higher in the non-Russian border regions than the centre. Thus, it is precisely the special concrete historical features of the national question in Russia that make the recognition of the right of nations to self-determination in the present period a matter of special urgency in our own country." And so over the time, Lenin developed this theory. And as we'll see, he was forced to defend it against both the right and the left. And in by 1917, he more posed the question in terms of imperialism and in terms of fighting nationalism in the working class. And I'll talk about these developments later. But for now, Lenin's basic preoccupation in supporting national liberation was creating a world where genuine equality and democracy prevailed between different nations. And this would be a basic prerequisite for internationalist unity and would remove a major source of division amongst the working class. So in terms of the 1903 Congress, there are a number of debates at the 1903 Congress, and they're quite complex. I'll just foreshadow one. It was between the Luxembourgists, and I'll deal with them in more detail in a second. But suffice to say, Lenin didn't realise this at the time, but objectively, his positions in 1903 were well ahead of those prevalent in the Second International. That was the body that united the European Socialist Movement. And the 1903 programme was in many ways the basis of all of Lenin's future views on national liberation. So the Second International, the international socialist organisation more or less led by the German Social Democratic Party, it contained many shades of opinion on national liberation, and all of them were wrong, but in different ways. The first and worst were the Austro-Marxists. The key theorist of the Austro-Marxists was Otto Bauer, and he believed that nations were an essential part of human society. He believed that all people with a claim to nationhood should have the right to enjoy a nation of their own. And really, he argued that capitalism prevented people from fully developing their own national culture by excluding certain classes from the nation. Internationalism for Bauer was simply meant the economic cooperation between different nations. Within those nations, Bauer advocated cultural national autonomy for every nationality, in particular within the Austrian Empire. That was where he was. And he supported, on top of that, economic integration. So this led Bauer to support the logic that already divided and atomised the working class. Rather than treat workers as a group to be unified, the Austro-Marxist position entrenched their differences by emphasising and glorifying cultural and national differences. So in many ways, Bauer's position was the worst of all worlds. It accepted the division of the working class into national groups and did nothing to really support oppressed nations because it legitimised the Habsburg Empire. And so Lenin's argument against this was twofold. By refusing to incorporate political succession and the right to demand succession into the right of nations to self-determination, the Austro-Marxists were turning it into a hollow phrase which objectively reinforced capitalism. Cultural autonomy without genuine political self-determination was at best meaningless and at worst a legitimisation of segregation. And by advocating that cultural and linguistic autonomy and therefore segregation, they are encouraging the working class to internalise the divisions created by capitalism. So in relation to cultural and linguistic questions, Lenin, of course, supported the demand that children be educated in their own language and that people have the right to use their own language. But at the same time, he opposed segregation by, for instance, supporting integrated schools where students with different linguistic needs had those needs met. So the Second International mainstream wasn't as bad as all that. They accepted on paper that dominated nations should have the right to self-determination. And they emphasised internationalism in their rhetoric. And they took this from Marx and Engels. But rather than adapting Marx's Engels' approach to a changing reality, they saw the national question as one of receding importance. They saw national liberation as a demand completely tied up with bourgeois revolutions and the struggle for democracy. And so much of the work that Lenin did to advance the theory of national liberation was ignored by the Second International. They condemned in motions colonialism. They said it was robbery. They did that in 1900 and 1901. But they saw little role for colonised people in opposing that colonisation. And while the positions they had were formally correct, albeit out of date, this was a cover for increasing nationalism. This is because the bulk of the parties in the Second International were essentially national reformist parties. At this stage, well and truly into the process of integrating themselves within their respective capitalist states. And so this meant that in 1914, as is well known, the bulk of the parties in the Second International supported their own governments and their own ruling classes in the imperialist war. Even prior to this, though, there were signs of the political degeneration. In 1904, at an Amsterdam conference, a Dutch delegate, Van Kol, argued in favour of colonialism and argued that even under socialism, colonialism would be a force for good in the world. And there were other such examples of this awful argumentation. Edward Bernstein, was in particular a defender of this right-wing, the sort of intellectual founder of reformism, was a defender of colonialism. So while these arguments were a minority in the Second International up until 1914, they reflected something important. In practice, the parties of the Second International had long ago ceased to represent the revolutionary interests of workers and the oppressed. And so the Second International's betrayal at the onset of World War I was one of the major things that forced Lenin to update and extend his theory of imperialism, firstly, but related to that, self-determination, national liberation. And I'll get to that in a second. The third major tendency within the Second International was much better, and that was Rosa Luxemburg's position. in contrast to the opportunist mainstream of the Second International, Rosa Luxemburg was a revolutionary fighter. And so I want to spend a little more time on Lenin's controversy with her. She stood on the far left of the Second International. And while they didn't realize it at the time necessarily, Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin did share a lot of political positions in common. On the national question, however, her views were very much shaped by her experiences in politics in Poland. And Poland at the time was dominated by Russia. It was a central part of the Tsarist Empire, containing key industrial areas and an organized and political working class. Workers' struggle in Russia often found an echo in Poland. And as such, Rosa Luxemburg's priority, correctly in my view, was to argue for political unity between Russian and Polish workers. Opposed to this was the right-wing Polish Socialist Party. They argued for nationalism. They paid some lip service to socialism. Basically this party was, right-wing nationalist. They were sympathetic towards the Habsburg Empire. They, during the 1905 revolution, they opposed workers' struggle in Poland on the basis that it undermined national unity. And they regularly argued that national unity needed to come above all other questions, so including the interests of the working class. And much of Luxembourg's early political career was spent in political struggle against their right-wing influence. And so from this, Rosa Luxemburg constructed a theory that argued that national liberation struggles were utopian and fundamentally a distraction from the class struggle. She extended this view and attempted to give it an economic foundation by arguing that under imperialism there was no such thing as genuine independence for nations and no possibility for the liberation of smaller nations shy of a worldwide socialist revolution. In Rosa Luxemburg's view, the call for a new nation in an imperialist world system was the same as the call for a new imperial power. No such thing as national independence was possible. And, of course, after the worldwide socialist revolution, there would be no point in demanding national independence as we'd have internationalism. This position is best described as an ultra-left attitude towards the national question. And it was mistaken in an important series of ways. And Lenin expended a lot of energy and a lot of ink polemicising against Rosa Luxemburg in the lead-up to World War I. And in this, a number of important points came out about Lenin's theory. Lenin was sympathetic towards Rosa Luxemburg's position in relation to Poland. He argued that she had performed an enormous service in Poland to the cause of revolution by combating nationalism in favour of working-class unity and working-class internationalism. What Lenin objected to most of all was Luxembourg's insistence, as early as 1903, that her position in relationship to Poland should become the position of socialists everywhere. Lenin, on the contrary, argued for an exceedingly concrete analysis. From the point of view of Russia, Lenin argued that it was absolutely necessary to demand Polish liberation. This is because the key enemy for workers in Russia was great Russian nationalism and the Russian ruling class. The way to break people away from this was to emphasise Poland's right to be free from the Russian Empire, just as Lenin had advocated for Russia's defeat in World War I. And Lenin, following Marx's arguments about Ireland, argued that Russian workers had to support the struggle of oppressed workers within the Russian Empire. And he wrote, "Let us consider the position of an oppressor nation. Can a nation be free if it oppresses other nations? It cannot. The interest of freedom of the great Russian population requires a struggle against such oppression. The long, centuries-old history of suppression of the movements of the oppressed nations and the systematic propaganda in favour of such suppression coming from the upper classes have created enormous obstacles to the cause of freedom of the great Russian people itself in the form of prejudices, etc." This was the key argument in Russia. In Poland, while Luxembourg was wrong to completely reject the demand for secession, doing so really just left the space open for the Polish nationalists to dominate that field, she was correct to make the Polish nationalists a target of her polemic. But imagine polemicising in the same way against Polish nationalism from within Russia. To do so would render objective support for the Russian Empire and great Russian chauvinism. And so Luxembourg's inability to see that each national question required a very specific series of demands based on a contextual analysis was a big blind spot in her theory. Now, as I mentioned, Rosa Luxemburg furnished her rejection of national liberation with an economic theory of imperialism. And her position was shared by a number of Russian Marxists, and chief amongst them was Bukharin, who was a key Bolshevik theorist. And he was the author of the quite well-known book Imperialism and World Economy, which was and is the best thing written on imperialism. And he pioneered the understanding of imperialism that we share today. So it's not so much his theory of imperialism, or for that matter Rosa Luxemburg's, that I want to take issue with. It's more that his approach to national liberation and Rosa Luxemburg's approach to national liberation incorrectly drew on an otherwise correct theory of imperialism. In essence, they argued that the imperialist stage of capitalism makes national independence completely impossible. No nation could be free from other nations economically. And Luxemburg and Bukharin argued correctly that imperialism meant division of the world between blocks of competing capitalist powers. Capitalist nations had two options: become imperialist nations themselves or become dominated by imperialism. And so for the colonial world, Rosa Luxemburg wrote, "The development of international trade in the capitalist period brings with it the inevitable, though at times slow, ruin of all the more primitive societies, destroying their existing means of self-determination, and makes them dependent on the crushing wheel of capitalist development and world politics." The conclusion that Rosa Luxemburg drew was that a general attempt to divide all existing states into national units and to retail them on the model of national states and statelets is completely hopeless, historically speaking, and a reactionary undertaking. Echoing her, in 1915, Bukharin wrote, "The slogan of self-determination of nations is first of all utopian, which is to say it cannot be realised within capitalism, and harmful as a slogan that disseminates illusions." Lenin responded to this with contempt on a number of levels. Firstly, it was wrong theoretically. National independence was and is possible under capitalism. The number of examples prove that clearly. Lenin referred to the secession of Norway from Sweden in 1905, but really, adjustments in world imperialism, adjustments and struggles of the oppressed can bring about national liberation, as the 20th century has shown in spades. There were the anti-colonial revolutions following World War II, or the redivision of the Middle East based on plans drawn up by imperialist powers. All of these created independent nation-states. But Lenin continued to argue that this misses the point. Even if certain demands were unachievable under capitalism, some must still be supported. And Lenin applied this to the colonial question. Not demand the immediate liberation of the colonies would play into the hands of the imperialist bourgeoisie in the dominant nation. And moreover, even if the demands were impossible under capitalism, they should still be demanded because they point towards ending capitalism. And so against the ultra-lefts, he wrote, "The intensification of national oppression under imperialism makes it necessary for social democracy not to renounce what the bourgeoisie describes as the utopian struggle for the freedom of nations to secede, but on the contrary, to take more advantage than ever before of conflicts arising also on this ground for the purpose of rousing mass action and revolutionary attacks on the bourgeoisie." This is important. The 1916 pamphlet, The Socialist Revolution and the Right of Nations to Self-Determination, it's in this book, if you can find it, marks a shift, because in it, Lenin situated the national question directly in the context of world imperialism. Self-determination was no longer just about fighting for democracy, but it was a crucial part of the fight against imperialism. So Lenin wrote, "The semi-colonial countries such as China, Persia and Turkey and all the colonies have a combined population of 1 billion. In these countries, the bourgeois democratic movements either have hardly begun or still have a long way to go. Socialists must not only demand the unconditional and immediate liberation of the colonies without compensation, and this demand in its political expression signifies the right of nations to self-determination. They must also render determined support to the more revolutionary elements in the bourgeois democratic movements for national liberation in these countries and assist their uprising or revolutionary war, in the event of one, against the imperialist powers that oppress them." So otherwise, Lenin accused the Luxembourg and the Russian ultra-lefts of what he called imperialist economism. And this means that they reduced the political question of self-determination, the political oppression of subjugated nations, to the economic system of imperialism. So Lenin would have agreed that to demand economic national independence is utopian, but to demand political independence, that is, a democratic, independent, sovereign state free from foreign coercion, is quite a different thing. And the same dialectical relationship between economics and politics is necessary to understand capitalism itself. The economic basis for socialism, after all, exists today, but it is the political rule of capitalism, the rule of the bourgeoisie, that prevents us getting there. So the ultra-lefts refused to make this distinction when it came to self-determination, and in doing so, they cut themselves off from an important force against imperialism. And just as a note, Lenin was far more hostile in his approach to Bukharin who was a Russian Jew, and Piatkov, who was a Russified Ukrainian, than he was to Rosa Luxemburg, because their context was Russia. So their arguments were much more to the benefit of Russian imperialism than Luxemburg's were. So anyway, from 1914 onwards, there's a couple more points to draw out about Lenin's theory. And partly the collapse of the Second International in the face of World War I forced Lenin to view national liberation also in terms of the ideology of the workers' movement, both in the oppressor countries and in the oppressed countries. And so, as I've argued earlier, in the imperialist countries, this means that workers need to recognise that they have an interest in the liberation of nations dominated by their own country. And Lenin adopted and extended this point from Marx. But this also applies in the oppressed countries. Workers in the oppressed countries will inevitably be inclined towards a nationalist worldview, and their national movements will be led by the bourgeoisie, or petty bourgeois aspirants to power. To form a class consciousness is a consciousness that puts working class solidarity first. Above national solidarity, workers need to learn from their own experiences. Two things are important in this. First of all, workers must struggle for and achieve national independence. And during and after this struggle, the class interests of the nationalist ruling class will push them into conflict with their own working class. The role of revolutionaries is to argue for working class independence in the struggle and against class collaboration. Secondly, the workers in the oppressor country have a role to play in demonstrating, by their own actions, solidarity with the workers in the oppressed country. If the workers' movement in the oppressor country remains nationalist and racist, it will be much harder for workers in the oppressed country to be won to genuine internationalism. Now, these two points start to go into Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution. I'm not going to talk about that because that's a whole other talk. But there is one key point that Lenin raised that it is important that it be made. And so he argued revolutionaries unconditionally support national liberation, but do not gloss over the politics of the leadership of national liberation struggles. And so in 1922, Lenin wrote the following. We must keep in mind the need for a determined struggle against attempts to give a communist colouring to bourgeois democratic liberation trends in the backward countries. The Communist International must enter into a temporary alliance with bourgeois democracy in the colonial and backward countries, but it should not merge with it, and should under all circumstances uphold the independence of the proletarian movement, even in its most embryonic form. This is key for understanding the 20th century. There were a whole number of essentially bourgeois national liberation movements that called themselves communist, Marxist, socialist, you name it, that came to power and created essentially state capitalist dictatorships. Lenin was conscious of this possibility, and so he argued in that situation for the precise tactics that would lead workers to liberation. And so his theory, in sum, can be said to be unconditional but critical support for national liberation. So I want to talk just quickly for the last bit of my talk about what happened in Russia after 1917. In October 1917, as people would know, the Soviets, led by the Bolshevik Party, took power and created a workers' state. In doing so, they overthrew the provisional government, the state representing Russian capitalism. On the 2nd of November, just days after the revolution, the new workers' government issued a decree guaranteeing the following points. 1. Equality and sovereignty for the peoples of Russia. 2. The right of the peoples of Russia to free self-determination up to secession and the formation of an independent state. 3. Abolition of all and any national and national religious privileges and restrictions. And 4. Free development of national minorities and ethnic groups inhabiting Russia. The constitution of the workers' state that was agreed upon in July 1918 made this more clear. Soviets of any nationality or ethnically distinct people in Russia could come together and democratically decide whether or not they would join the Socialist Federation. The Commissariat of Nationalities was established, and it had an overwhelming non-Russian composition. Many of the prominent Bolshevik leaders were non-Russian. Amongst them were Jews, Ukrainians, Poles, Georgians, and people from other oppressed nationalities within the former Russian Empire. And between 1917 and 1923, a total of 17 autonomous regions and republics were set up in Russia and four outside Russia, and all of this amidst the context of civil war. In about 7 of the autonomous republics that were set up by 1920, amongst the non-Russian population, the majority supported Islam, and they were granted enormous autonomy and complete freedom of religion by the Bolsheviks. The socialist state, in some cases, even sponsored the construction of mosques, which had previously been prohibited under Tsarism. The Bolsheviks also attempted to address the economic backwardness of those areas by undertaking massive investment programs, well and truly disproportionate to the investment in the rest of Russia. And the revolutionary government endeavoured to demonstrate as much cultural sensitivity as it possibly could towards the nations in question. For one example, by 1923, the government had trained 45,000 Ukrainian language teachers, where previously there'd been just a handful. And they argued that at least 100,000 would be required to meet the needs of the Ukrainian people. The Commissariat of Nationalities decreed that the minimum number of students required to warrant formal education in their native language in any given school would be 25. So that's in advance of what even exists in Australia today. And the Communist Party itself made extraordinary efforts to attract supporters from a variety of different national backgrounds. And so all of these efforts meant that in a large number of cases, the populations of oppressed nations supported the Russian Revolution. And this is one of the key aspects of the revolution's victory over the whites in the Civil War. Had the Bolshevik Party followed a more nationalist or a more ultra-left policy, it's really impossible to see how they could have survived the Civil War. Now, it was an enormously complex period, and the Bolsheviks made mistakes at the time, and Lenin was involved in a number of fierce debates against people in his own party that got it wrong from either an ultra-left point of view or a right-wing point of view, and often the two were quite similar. So I'm not going to go into all of those debates, because that's a whole other talk. Suffice to say, the period directly following the Russian Revolution was the single greatest period in human history of liberation for people racially, ethnically, and religiously oppressed. No other period has existed like it. So, to conclude, to sum up really quickly, I want to just go through once more the essentials of Lenin's theory. Self-determination and succession are essential to internationalism, to genuine internationalism. Socialists have to unconditionally support national liberation struggles that are objectively in the interests of the liberation of the working class. This is because A, they are democratic. B, they damage capitalism and imperialism. And C, it is the only way to win workers to genuine internationalism. This means different things in different countries. In oppressor countries, supporting secession and combating chauvinism are the main questions. In oppressed countries, criticising nationalism and revolutionaries attempting to win leadership of national liberation movements are the main things. Socialists have to be critical of leaderships of national liberation struggles and only given support to genuinely progressive elements of these struggles. And five, failure to do any of this renders objective support for imperialism and nationalism. And these basic points, I would argue, underpin our theory of national liberation today.